This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. My first guest today is Andre Brouwer, who stars in a new drama series premiering next Tuesday on the FX network. It's called Thief, and Brouwer stars as Nick Atwater, an accomplished thief whose life of crime is a well-hidden secret from his wife and teen stepdaughter. But those two worlds threaten to intersect, as in this scene, when Nick is interrupted mid-robbery by his vibrating cell phone. He and his fellow thieves have just cracked into a walk-in safe, and on the other line, Nick's wife Wanda, played by Dina Meyer, calls with bad news about their daughter Tammy, played by Mae Whitman, and she's calling from a police station.
Damn it.
Come on, let's wrap it up. This is not a good time.
Tell me about it. I'm calling you from a police station. I want to talk to Tammy's father.
He's not my father.
You shut up.
What did she do?
Waited outside while some kids broke into the school.
And they're nice. These are her new friends.
Wanda, I can't do this right now.
I know I can.
I'm not a father.
Do you want to have this conversation right now? They are standing right here. They want to talk to somebody.
Okay. I'll take care of it. Put him on.
What is that noise?
Wanda, put him on.
Here you go.
This is Officer Milovich. Are you the father?
Stepfather. I'm in a meeting right now, officer. But I want to show you, Tammy has never been in any kind of trouble before.
Brouwer, of course, is best known for playing a cop, not a robber. From 1993 to 1998, he played Detective Frank Pembleton on Homicide: Life on the Street. It was a standout role, and an Emmy-winning role, in a groundbreaking show. Frank Pembleton was a Baltimore detective whose specialty was taking suspects into the interrogation room and getting them to confess. On that show, at that time, Brouwer was the best actor on television. Prior to Homicide, Brouwer was featured in the 1989 movie Glory as one of the Union soldiers in the first all-black fighting unit during the Civil War. He also starred in such TV movies as Murder in Mississippi, The Tuskegee Airmen, and The Court Martial of Jackie Robinson. In the years during and after Homicide, Andre Brouwer has appeared in several movies, including Primal Fear, City of Angels, and Duets. He'll soon appear as the captain in Poseidon, the remake of the disaster movie The Poseidon Adventure. And between Homicide and Thief, Brouwer starred in two other TV series, the well-received medical drama Gideon's Crossing, and the not-so-well-received character drama Hack. I spoke to Andre Brouwer earlier this week. Andre Brouwer, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
What do you look for in a script, especially in something that might go to TV series, to make you consider doing it?
Well, you know, I like messy dramas. So when I read the pilot, the question in my mind is there enough of a mess that needs to be cleaned up that will allow this show to live on? So that was true when I read The Sides, basically, when I was doing Homicide. I was intrigued by the character of Pembleton that they had laid out for me. That was true when I did Gideon's Crossing. I said, this is a hell of a mess. I pretty much know from the moment I finish reading the script, I pretty much know whether or not I'm going to do the episode, to be a part of the piece. And that was true with the show that David Morse starred in called Hack down in Philadelphia. And that's true also with Nick Atwater here in Thief.
If you know when it's over, when you finished reading the entire script, that's one thing. When's the first moment in this script, in Thief, where it grabbed you and said, well, no, this is something I really want to keep reading and there might be some gold here? Was there such a moment?
Well, it's somewhere around the time that, in retrospect, I think, it's somewhere around the time where Nick picks up the phone in the vault and has a conversation with Wanda. It's the blending of two different worlds. And Nick has been such a master at keeping these worlds separate. He's been such an accomplished thief and liar and husband, and been able to keep these worlds separate, and now they're starting to blend. From the moment that these worlds start to blend, Nick has a decision about being a very wise thief or being a very wise father, and they seem to be mutually incompatible. And what I saw in this pilot was a man who's going to be forced to choose what his loyalties were. Were they loyalties to his nature in terms of being a thief, or were they going to be loyalties in terms of what he hoped to be as a man, which was a good father and a good husband? And because they're seemingly incompatible, the fallout is going to be terrific. And I want to be around to see how he gets out of this one.
You shot the pilot on location in New Orleans Yes. in 2004.
Yes.
And then it was picked up much later than most series usually are, almost a year later. And you mm-hmm. were just about to start and go back down and do location shooting again in New Orleans, and Katrina hit. What was that like?
Yes.
What was that like?
Well, I was up in Jersey. I was flying down maybe on the 7th of September to start this, and we were on vacation, as a matter of fact, when Katrina struck. At first, I didn't realize how serious the damage was in New Orleans. I thought it was going to be easily contained. But the more I heard and the more I read, I began to realize this is a much, much bigger issue, and that consequently everything had changed right before our very eyes. They immediately began to think about what it was that we were going to do. Filming was suspended. Even the idea of filming was suspended in New Orleans, and we had to start thinking about where we were going to go and what we were going to do. And various locations were bandied about, Los Angeles, Chicago, Vancouver, Toronto, just other places, Atlanta, which we could either move this series to and set it in that locale, or use those locations to as a convincing double for New Orleans. And mm-hmm. eventually we settled on Shreveport, which was only 5 hours north of New Orleans. And Shreveport welcomed our production with open arms and were very, very helpful. And we're able to complete the season. Most of the crew, who were all based in New Orleans, made the journey up to Shreveport. Shreveport has, in essence, become the new hub of filmmaking in New Orleans, in Louisiana. And we successfully completed it. I think we have a convincing double for New Orleans. Katrina is a much, much larger story than we could ever possibly contain within Thief. So we folded it in places that we found to be appropriate. But the story of rebuilding New Orleans is much bigger than Thief, and we couldn't do it justice. And so consequently, we refer to it in places that I feel are appropriate without minimizing the wreckage and the damage of Katrina.
Forgive me if this is a sort of naive question, but does the reputation of FX at this point enter into it at all in terms of your deciding to do this series because of it getting well established with S.H.I.E.L.D. and Nip Tuck and Rescue Me and even Over There, that it can be a place to do TV, or was it purely based on what was on the script?
It was a consideration. You know, 2 years ago, FX was an upstart, more of an upstart than it is right now. Right now, it's being favorably compared, even though it's basic cable, to HBO mm-hmm. in terms of the kind of content that they're willing to put on air. But 2 years ago, that wasn't necessarily true. What intrigued me about the show is their willingness to support a show. They did very good work, and they promoted and supported their shows. And so consequently, I took great comfort in the fact that when they believed in the material and they were willing to stand by their creators as well as the talent who was involved in their shows, then consequently we would get a real shot at going on the air and staying on the air. And that's been important to me ever since Gideon's Crossing, which was a show that I felt was prematurely pulled. And so what was important to me is I want to do a show where I think I can do my best work, but I also want to be in the air next year. And I want to be given an opportunity to do that based upon our merits and the quality of our work rather than short-term consideration.
I have some homicide questions.
Well, okay.
Well, one is because I remember going down to visit the set at one point, and mm-hmm. I was amazed at the method of filming, which was to make you poor actors run through the entire scene from beginning to end with a single camera, shooting it from wherever it was pointing, and then stopping and doing it again a second or a third time. And I guess emotionally it must be more exciting because rather than just doing pickups and close-ups, you're getting to the truth of the scene each time. But I also thought, man, that's heavy lifting. What was that like?
It was fun. It was fun from, I mean, it was fun. and I really, really enjoyed my time down there in Baltimore. I felt more like I was on stage than any other piece that I've ever been involved with. When we first started, of course, everything that we were doing, we were pushing the envelope in terms of how we were using the camera and the kinds of stories that we were telling. But subsequently, I mean, over the next couple of years, so many people adopted those same techniques that it's now become quite commonplace. But when we first started, it was unheard of to have a 16 millimeter camera sitting on Jean de Sagonzac's shoulder and running through the entire scene from mm-hmm. beginning to end. And Tom Fontana wrote long scenes. The one that I think back in particular from our first season was the episode 6 where Bayless, Pembleton, and the Araber are in the box basically for 44 minutes. Moses Gunn and Kyle Secor and myself sitting in the box for 44 minutes, and we would do huge scenes, page after page of dialogue, and then we'd stop and we'd do it from another angle. But in essence, we were doing a play. We were doing a drama in which it was just as dangerous as if we were on stage and it was happening right there before our very eyes. And we got a lot of very interesting, spontaneous human emotion by filming it that way. And I loved it. I absolutely adored it. Now, my subsequent shows have been different from that, but my love of the filmmaking on Homicide has never changed. I'm thrilled with it.
Well, I can tell you that I share your being thrilled with that particular episode, which was called Three Men and Adina.
Right.
And Fontana wrote it, and I have always held it up as one of the best hours of dramatic television I've ever seen written and performed. And it is the other clip that I brought in to play today, a piece from this, because I thought, you know, essentially it boils down to your character of Frank Pembleton and Kyle Secor's character of Tim Bayless as two detectives who have 12 hours to try to flip a prime suspect played by Moses Gunn as the Araber. And so the scene that I want to play is at the very beginning, where basically at this early point in the interrogation, Pembleton is acting very friendly and very loose and very curious and polite. And it's Tim Bayless who's acting impatient and trying to push in and to ask questions about the young girl, Adina Watson, who was killed. So you ready to hear a little bit of this one?
Yes.
Okay, so here we go with Homicide: Life on the Street.
For the record, your name is Risley Tucker?
Yeah.
You live at 2003 Greenmount?
Yeah.
How long have you lived at the present address?
All my life.
Really? No one in the neighborhood calls you Risley, do they? No one calls you Mr. Tucker?
No.
They all call you the Araber.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that term Araber has caused a lot of trouble around here. Two other detectives got into this big argument because one says Araber and the other says Arab. Both grew up in Baltimore, but they have different expressions for her.
Mm-hmm.
I never heard of either not being a native, but it has nothing to do with being an Arab, right? I mean, you don't look Arabic or Arabian.
No.
So what does it mean?
We go from neighborhood to neighborhood selling fruits and vegetables from a cart, a horse-drawn cart.
Oh.
We're like nomads.
How long have you worked as an Arab?
All my life.
How long did you know Adina Watson? You remember the first time that you met her?
I'm sorry. This Arab thing, this fascinates me. Moving about the city, selling fruits and vegetables. I'm used to going to a supermarket, a food town or something, you know? Are your prices cheaper?
No.
Then what's the advantage of buying from you? I mean, other than the obvious one, you come to people's front door, people have to get in their car and drive 10 blocks.
Fresher produce.
Well, is that
what did you think about Adina? I mean, Frank and I here, we didn't really know her that well. What would you say about her personality? Was she feisty, outgoing? Energetic?
Yeah.
So she worked for you how long? Doing what?
Taking care of Magdalene.
Magdalene?
My horse. Clean out Magdalene's coat with a curry comb, untangling the mane and the tail.
That sounds like a great job for a girl. Why'd she stop working for you?
Horse died.
There's any other reason?
My barn burned down.
That's the only other reason?
I stopped being an Arab.
Any other reason?
There was no more job.
Adina's mother didn't make her stop working for you. Huh? Isn't it true that Mrs. Watson was afraid for her daughter because you were getting a little too friendly with her?
Huh? Is being an Arab a good job? I mean, are you respected in the community?
Most people think of us as vagrants. But since the economy gone sour, you see a lot of people selling on the street.
Your whole family are Arabs?
You know, we had a sort of an argument beforehand about where to cut off this clip, and we couldn't
never stop.
We couldn't cut off the clip. It was just too good. It's not only great television, but it's great radio. What are your memories of filming that episode?
Well, we had, I don't know, 14 pages a day to do. My most visceral memory was we would leave the set and I would go home and I would sit down and I'd learn 14 pages of dialogue a day. But I do have to say Moses Gunn really turned into a very sweet performance in my mind, because it's never definitive whether or not that he had anything to do with Adina Watson's murder. But at the very end of the show, he says, you know, why should I be proud? Why should, you know, he's crying, he's weeping. He says, why should I be proud? Why should I be happy when I'm forced to admit that the greatest love of my life was an 11-year-old girl? And nothing's definitive by saying that she's the great love of his life. But what I begin to realize is that, once again, the great pathos of this episode comes from the fact that we begin to really actually realize that Risley Tucker loved this girl. And we're talking fictionally, of course, because mm-hmm. in real life we have no evidence to that effect. But this is part of Tom Fontana's genius, is that we are never quite certain as to what it is that we have on our hands. Because evidence may point in one way, and our feelings about the Arab may point in a certain direction, but Tom's genius is that he's written a man who's fully dimensional. So consequently, there is a tremendous amount of heartbreak and sadness on his part because Adina's no longer alive. But what I also think is interesting about what Tom did in this episode is that I came in firmly convinced that the Arab was not the man, as a prime suspect, that this was absolutely boneheaded, and that the rookie had gone out on a limb. And by the end, Pembleton feels quite certain that the Arab is the man. Is the man, and Bayless is not so certain at all, you know, based upon the same interview and the same information that we gained. So I really enjoyed working on this piece with Tom. Tom's written some dynamite episodes over the years, as has Jim Yashimura. Jim and Tom worked very closely together during those years, and I have to say they really turned in some spectacular episodes. Tom wrote the episode where Pembleton has a stroke. He wrote it over the weekend. He called me up and he said, because I'd said to him, basically, I think we've played all the stories with this Pembleton character, and maybe it's time for me to move on. And he says, well, no, I don't think so. He says, let me put my thinking cap on. So he came back and he said, he called me on the phone. Maybe it was Thursday he called me on the phone. He says, you know, Andre, I think I'd like to give your character a stroke. And I said, huh, that sounds really interesting. I said, it really sounds interesting. Let me run it by my boss. So I spoke with Amy, and Amy's an actress also.
Amy,
and she
your
understands,
wife, yes.
Amy, my wife. And yeah. She understands how challenging and meaty this would happen. And I said to Tom, I said, my only condition is that I not immediately recover and have a spunky therapist that I grow to love and all of the cliches that come with rehabilitation. I said, I would like to do some research so that I could, we can tell these stories in a much more, I think, truthful manner. So during that summer, the summer of 1996, between seasons, I went to the Rusk Institute in New York City to learn about stroke and the rehabilitation from stroke. I was doing Henry V out in the park by night and over at the Rusk Institute for rehabilitation by day. And for me, the aftermath of the stroke, it was not so much about the rehabilitation, but how fundamentally changed all of our relationships were by the fact of Pembleton's stroke. So his marriage is falling apart. because he is absolutely obsessive about getting back on the force, because he considers what he does to be vastly more important than holding his wife's hand or raising his daughter or anything. He actually rather would be standing over a dead body cracking jokes with his pals, mm-hmm, in the middle of the night than he would rather be doing anything. So his marriage suffers terribly by the fact that he'll do anything to get back on the force, including not taking his medication that so that he can pass the gun test. And whereas he was once the grizzled veteran and Bayless was the rookie, the power has changed absolutely in the relationship. And in a certain way, we flip places. So at one time, Pembleton was first among equals, and now he's a much more humble man.
You had a long career in television, even predating Homicide. And mm-hmm, if I have your early career right, where you came to acting fairly late at Stanford, I don't know if you finished all of your degrees and were out of Juilliard before you began acting professionally, or if you were juggling the two. But
I came to acting, I guess I was 20 years old, somewhere in my sophomore year. I changed my major at Stanford University. So I graduated with a BA in drama in 84. Mm-hmm. And graduated from Juilliard 4 years later in 88. And then my first movie experience was Glory in 1989. We came out the Christmas of 89. And I did a little bit of television and a lot of stage before that movie broke, which began to create a reputation, I think, as a moral force, mm-hmm, a moral reputation as an actor. And I've done a variety of feature films, but television has always been my mainstay, and I enjoy television, so it works out.
Well, let's talk about two of those very early things. I mean, with Glory, you mm-hmm were right there with Denzel Washington, who was just off of or still in St. Elsewhere, and Morgan Freeman and Matthew Broderick, and a very ambitious movie. And then the first thing I saw you on television was on the remake of Kojak with Telly Savalas. You know, and I'm sorry, I've been a TV critic for a long time. And
wow.
And I don't know if you're exhausted from answering Kojak questions, but I have one for you.
Okay.
You're doing Glory, you know, yeah, you're out of Juilliard, you're out of Stanford, and you're doing Kojak. What was that like?
It was a tremendous opportunity, and I think I was wise to be involved with it. It was my first experience with television. We were doing two-hour movies of the week, and I said to myself, you know, this is, I think, the right thing to do. It was one of the golden opportunities. Oddly enough, it was one of the golden opportunities that I was wise enough to actually go ahead and pick up. And so I look back and say, yeah, that turned out good. So I guess we did five or six of those little television movies, but I really enjoyed it and really introduced me to the craft of television acting. Acting is acting wherever you go, but there's certain things that you need to know about the pace of television work. And so so I was happy to be a part of that.
When you talk about acting on television and learning how to act on television, what did you learn from Kojak, from those early TV movies, that you needed to learn to be a better TV actor?
That the terrific pace of television demanded a tremendous amount of preparation in before I even stepped foot on the set. So I knew from that moment that I needed to be superbly well prepared if I was going to be able to be a success at this. The pace that we used on Kojak was so accelerated that if it was good for the camera, it was good. So on many occasions, everything was one take, maybe two.
Mm-hmm.
So in that way, it resembled almost watching, you know, daytime drama. It was very, very camera oriented. And I knew that in order to be successful at that, I would have to be very well prepared. So that the necessity of creating for myself a compelling and specific backstory, as well as knowing my lines in intimate detail and all of their import, meant that if I discovered anything on set, that I had a foundation for to deal with it. And that served me well in television. The pace has always been accelerated. For example, when we did when we came down to Shreveport to do the remaining five episodes of Thief this season, we mm-hmm. had 5 days of rehearsal. Well, 5 days of rehearsal is an incredible luxury on television, and I made the most of that by making sure, in a certain way, while we were in rehearsal, to find out what was at the bottom of these scenes to the best of my ability, so that when the time came on set, I had already dealt with and discarded all of the choices that I felt were wrong, you know, so that the stuff that I was doing on set was much more of what I thought was the essence of Nick's character. I left a lot of bad choices in the rehearsal room, and for me, that was essential to reaching the next step with this character.
Well, your performances on television have been so much fun for me to watch over the years. So thanks very much. Thanks for being here on Fresh Air, Andre.
My pleasure.
Andre Brower. His new series, Thief, premieres on the FX network next Tuesday.